Okay, how is everybody? Thank you all for your patience and willingness to move rooms. We are all set. My name is Robert Green, and I'm a technical evangelist in the Developer and Platform Evangelism Group here at Microsoft, and my specialty is Visual Studio, and particularly enterprise development on Windows 8, so line of business apps. Here's my email address. If you have any questions on this stuff at all, please feel free to email me. And so how many of you were in Kushal's session just prior? Great, so quite a bit. So he talked about sort of the whys of building line of business apps on Windows 8, showed some great examples of Windows 8 business apps, Windows Store business apps. And you guys went to the keynote, and you got your devices, and you've been attending the talks, and you are all completely sold on this Windows 8 thing. You agree with us that it's going to be a gigantic hit. You're ready to go back and move your businesses forward and build apps, and you're going to hit pockets of resistance from time to time, right? Well, here is the number one way that you, the thing that you can pull out of your back pocket when you've given all your arguments about productivity and Windows Reimagined and all the technical reasons why people should move forward, and then people are just still not sold. You pull this one out of the back of your pocket. Oprah loves the Surface. We're done here, ladies and gentlemen. Let's start building apps. Okay. So what are we here today to talk about? Anytime you move to a new platform, and you know, those of us who have been in the industry for a while, and sometimes longer than we will ever dare admit, we've seen a lot of platform changes. And every time I go to a new platform, the same questions keep popping up in my head. How do I do, you know, what's new in the platform? What are the new advantages? But when it comes time to actually write code, the questions are, how do I do this? How do I do that? How do I do a lot of the same things that I'm doing today on this new platform? Yes, I want to know how to take advantage of new things, but I want to know, how do I do the usual things I'm doing? And so what I wanted to do in this talk is answer some of those questions and look at some of the things that, as we approach this new platform, we're going to want to know how we do. And I have an hour, so I had to leave a lot of things off the list. The original version of the list of things I wanted to cover was a lot longer, and I've narrowed it down to these things. So I want to talk about data, security and authentication. So what data can I talk to? How do I talk to that data? How do I make sure that only the right people are accessing this application? I had originally had UI controls on here, but there are a lot of talks on that, and at this point, all of our great partners have released Windows 8 controls. Component 1 and Infragistics and DevExpress and Telerik and SyncFusion, etc. They all have WinRT controls out, so we're not going to cover that here. But we'll talk about data, we'll talk about security and authentication, we'll talk about testing and deployment a little bit. Kushal covered it quite a bit in his talk before, but we'll talk about those because it's a little bit different this time. We have a range of devices, and we also have, you know, the ARM devices as well as the x86-64 devices. So testing, you know, there's some issues, specific things there to Windows 8 that we want to talk about. So that's our agenda. So you're building a line of business application, and in all likelihood, it's going to talk to data. So what are your choices about where you store the data? Where do you store data locally? Where do you store data remotely? So for local data, you have a number of choices. You can use the application data APIs, which gives you local data, local storage, as well as roaming storage. You can use the HTML5 web storage, and those are both good for sort of unstructured data. If you want to get a little bit more structured, you can use IndexedDB, as well as this extensible storage engine. And if you want to get something that looks a little bit more like a SQL database, there are third-party databases like SQLite. We're going to drill down into these a little bit. And then, of course, there's remote data, whether it's in SQL Server, SQL Azure, Oracle, back-end systems. So you have a number of options. For local storage, if you just want settings, unstructured data files, then the application data APIs are the way to go. It gives you both a local and a roaming data store. So this would be perfect for things like settings and preferences. It's also perfect for something like state. And don't forget state, because you know today you fire up a WPF app, you get halfway in the middle of entering some data, and then you go to the water cooler, and then you are in a conversation, and then you go to a meeting, and then you go to lunch, and then you come back, and that form's still sitting there with the data. You sit down and you continue going. With Windows 8, you build a Windows Store app, and you switch over to another store app, then the app you are in will be suspended, and ultimately, if the system starts running out of resources, could be terminated. So we all know that if a user sits down and starts entering data, goes away, comes back, goes back to the app, and the data is gone, we do not have happy users. So state is very important in all apps, you know, particularly in a business app as well. So the application data APIs are a great way to handle that. And when I say available for all languages, I mean VB, C#, C++, JavaScript. So whether you're building XAML or JavaScript apps, you can use the application data APIs. If you want something more structured, you could use the Extensible Storage Engine. It's an ISAM storage technology for both structured and unstructured data, stored data in tables. We only supply the C and C++ APIs, so if you wanted to call it from C# or JavaScript or VB, then you could wrap those calls in a WinRT object. You could do that yourself. You could hope that someone has done that for you, and then you could use their code. If you're building a JavaScript app, you can use IndexedDB. You can use it for structured data, indexed. It's designed to hold simple values and hierarchical objects. It is an ISAM storage technology, so you can kind of see how far you can push it to look like a database and act like a database. It's key value pairs that can be indexed, so you can certainly store lots of data in there. Each app has a quota of 250 megabytes, so hopefully that would be enough. And then for third-party databases, there are things like SQLite, which is basically an in-memory, lightweight SQL database engine. Database is in a single file. It's free and open source on SQLite.org. And if you've looked into SQLite, you'll see that there are implementations of it across a wide variety of platforms. And if you're building a Visual Studio app, then we have the SQLite for Windows runtime extension for C#, VB, and C++, so in other words, for XAML. I would expect that there would eventually, that would hopefully soon be an extension as well for JavaScript. It's not quite there yet. So for the application API, for the IndexedDB, if you want to see code and learn how to use that, there are great samples that are out. Go to the Windows Developer Center, go to the samples. There is an application data sample, there's an IndexedDB sample, and then I'm going to show SQLite in the demo here very shortly. So those are some of the options for local data. What about remote data? Right, you've got data in SQL Server, Dynamics, SAP, all these back-end systems, and you've got services already written for them, or maybe you need to write new services. Those could be on-premise, those could be in the cloud, and we have a number of ways for you to talk to your existing services. You can do it through sockets, you can do it through HTTP using HTTP client, or WinJS.xhr. You can use Atom Pub syndication. You can also continue to use your old favorites, ASMX, WCF, OData, right? You go into Visual Studio, you add a service reference, you point to the data, you get the proxy client generated, and you just use that the same way you've been using it all along, understanding that all of your calls will be async. There are no synchronous calls out of a Windows Store app. But other than that, you use the service in the exact same manner. So I know I'm rushing through the slides. I'm going to rush through the slides so I have more time for demo. So I'm not going to talk this fast the entire time. Okay, so let's take a look at how we use SQLite. So I'm going to fire up Visual Studio, and I'm going to show, I've got four different versions of this application that we're going to look at today, but it's an expense report app. Let's just take a quick look at it. Come on, please work. There we go. So this is talking, this version is talking to a WCF service that's hosted in Azure, and the data is in a SQL Azure database. So when I come into the application, it shows sort of my dashboard. What are my existing charges that I've put on my credit card, whether it's the corporate card or my personal card? Are there any reports that I've started and saved but haven't submitted yet? Are there reports I've submitted that my manager hasn't approved yet? And then I can see my past reports. So if I go to charges, here are all my charges, and I see that I should probably file an expense report pretty soon because some of these are kind of old. I can go in and look at these. This is a corporate card charge, so the only thing I can modify are the notes, the description, and select a different category for it. I could swipe up and create a brand new charge for something I put on my personal credit card. I can select a couple of these and create an expense report out of them. So that's basically what the application does. Okay. So now, what I wanted to do for this application is I wanted to have support for offline. So I added SQLite to it. And so to do that, what I did, the first thing I did was I went to Tools, Extensions, and Updates. And I went out to the Visual Studio Gallery. And I did a search for SQLite. And it showed me SQLite for Windows Runtime. And then I noticed that there's also one for Windows Phone. And that's both 7 and 8. So that's already out there. That's kind of cool. So I installed SQLite for Windows Runtime as an extension. And that gives me the ability to use SQLite in my Visual Studio projects. Then what I did was I set a reference to SQLite as well as the C++ runtime. And then what I did was I went to NuGet and I got a package called SQLite-net, which gives me the ability to work with SQL in a link-like manner. And when I install that in this project, it gives me a couple additional files, this SQLite and this SQLite async down here at the bottom, and that gives me the capability of working with SQLite in a very familiar programming model. Okay. So that's all I needed to do to set up SQLite. So now what I want to do, when the application starts, if I'm online, I want to obviously bring down data from the service and store it locally. That way, subsequent calls to that data can be local, and also it gives me offline capability. So when the app starts up, is that font okay, or should I make it bigger? I'll take that as I make it bigger. Okay, how's that? All right, cool. So the database is in a file called expenses.sqlite, and it's stored in the applications folder. And then I'm going to connect to it using sqlite.sqlite connection, and then I'm going to create the tables if they don't exist. So I call create table, and for each table, I have a class that... Actually, let's just bump up the font. Always. What did I have that? 14 or 16? Let's make it 16. There. So I create a class for each table, and I can identify the primary key, SQLite.primary key. So when I start up, that's a little bit too much. Oh, is that why? Okay. Good point. There's probably a keyboard shortcut for that, but I don't remember it. Okay, so I'm going to create the tables if they don't exist, and then I'm going to go and get some data. So in my call here, get charges, I'm going to pass a parameter whether or not I want this to be an online request. The first time I get the data, I want it to be online. Subsequent to that, I can make it offline. How do I know the user's online? Networkinformation.getInternetConnectionProfile. If that returns a null, I'm not online. If it doesn't, if it returns something that's not null, I am online. So in that case, I go to the client, and I will, let's skip over this code that syncs charges. I'm going to come back to that in a second. And I Where is the actual call? Here it is. I knew it was in there somewhere. So I call the service and bring down the charges. Then what I'm going to do is clear out the local version of that table and populate it with the data I just brought back from the client. That way, subsequent calls to get charges will be made local, assuming that my charges information doesn't change constantly, right? Okay. So then, if I make a change, what I need to do is a couple of things. First of all, if I'm online, I want to send that data back to the service. So I make that call. And then what I want to do is update my local copy. So here's this code here will query the charge table, and I'm using a lambda to bring back the charge that meets that ID. Then I update the local version. And I mark that row as updated because I want to keep track of whether things were inserted or updated. And then I call db.update, and that actually does the updating in the database. Similarly, if this is a new charge, I call db.insert. Then what I'm going to do in the charges, if I go back to charges, every time I call get charges, if I'm online, I'm going to sync because now I have data stored locally and I can go offline. So when I go back online, when I call get charges for the first time when I load up that app, or maybe I have a sync button, then what I'm going to do is I've stored changes in a charge change table. So I have a table that's going to, it's kind of, you know, my history of changes. I'm going to look for updated or inserted rows or deleted rows and send those to the service, then empty out the change table. Right? So I've got the data on the service, I've got local versions of each table, I've got a change table where I'm keeping track of inserts, updates, and deletes, and I now have in this application offline and syncing using SQLite, as well as the ability to make one call to the service, bring back data, and then have subsequent calls local. And you know, you've seen the code. So here's the code to get data out of a table. And then we saw the code to insert or update into a table. And we saw code to query a table. So thanks to that SQLite-net NuGet package, it's very, very easy to work with SQLite. Okay? All right. So the good news is that this application now supports online and offline. The bad news is I got to, or had to, depending on your perspective, write all that data sync code myself. Who here has ever written data sync code? Who here loved that? Was ecstatic, thought that was the, yeah, exactly. Very, very, is it difficult? It's certainly involved code to write. It's a lot of code to write, a lot to keep track of what's going on. It's hard to test. And so what you really want is some kind of sync framework. You want somebody to go out and write a sync framework for you. And it turns out that we actually have one. Let's go back to here. We actually have a sync framework. Right? We released the sync framework 4.0 October 2010 CTP as open source code. And it's based on the sync framework 2.1. So what you could do is you could take that code and you could write a sync framework that works on Windows 8. Or what you could do is get somebody to write it for you, which is what we did. And we're going to be releasing this as a sample. So we have a sync framework for Windows runtime where the app calls the sync service, which is an OData service that talks to SQL Server, can be SQL Server, can be SQL Express, could be SQL Express, could be SQL Azure. And then the offline data is stored in SQLite. So let's see that in action. So let's call up my next sample. Now let me just run this, show you the app. This is FabriCam Fiber. You got to do a demo with FabriCam Fiber. It is actually, yes, it is in our contract. We have to use FabriCam Fiber. So the FabriCam Fiber techs are going out to customers because customers have issues. So for example, I see that at 9 o'clock I'm going to go see this Terry Duffy because you know, we did something wrong. So I go and I fix the problem and then I can close this ticket. Okay, pretty straightforward. The app's pretty straightforward. Let's talk about the scenario. I'm at work or I'm at my local coffee shop or at home. I've got connectivity. I start up the app and I download my schedule. Then I go to Terry Duffy's house. What am I going to do? Say, can I hook into your wireless while I'm here? No. And Terry says, you could if it worked. That's why you're here, right? So guess what? I don't have wireless. So I need an offline scenario. I need an offline story. Okay. So let's look at how that, I keep forgetting to, when I run Windows Startups in Visual Studio, I keep closing them, you know, in the app, and then remembering that I got to go back to Visual Studio and stop debugging. I'm so used to just swiping down. Okay, so we need a sync framework. So we are providing, come on, as a sample, this sync framework. So we have this project currently called Sync Toolkit WinRT. Okay, so let's run this. I'll show you what it does. And we have this sync service utility. So the first thing I want to do is generate a configuration file, which is going to let the service know exactly what I'm syncing. So I create a new sync file. I'll just store it on my desktop. I already have one, so I'm going to call this FabriCam Fiber 2. Okay. Now what I need to do is point it to a database, give it a config name, FabriCam Fiber, point to my database for our demo here. I'm using SQL Express on this machine, and then tell it what database to use, FabriCam Fiber. Now the FabriCam Fiber database, let me just show it to you, because I want to show it to you before and after configuring. It's got tables for customers, service tickets, etc. Okay, so now I've got the database pointed out. Now I can add a scope, and I'm going to add one scope called default scope. And a scope is for essentially scenarios. So I could have a scope that says only these tables. I could have a scope that says every table. I could create scopes for different sets of data. I'm just going to have a default scope. Next thing I do is select that scope and specify what tables I want to sync. Specify the database, and I want the customers table synced, and I want the service tickets synced. And if I wanted to, I could add filters to these if I only wanted to sync some of the data. There we go. Okay, click Next. And now what I get is an XML file. That doesn't work. It's an XML file that shows me there we go. Where is it? I saved it to the desktop, right? There it is. So I have this XML file that shows me what tables and what columns are in those tables that are going to be synced. Now the next thing I need to do is provision the database. So based on that same sync file, which has all of the information I need, I have provision and deprovision. Provision is by default. So now if I go in here and I refresh these tables, we'll see that I've added a bunch of tracking tables, customers tracking, service tickets tracking, along with some scope tables. So now the database is set up to support syncing. Then the last thing I need to do is generate some code. There's code that needs to go on the server, code that needs to go on the client in order to enable this syncing. So again, I need to go get my config file, which has all the instructions on how I'm going to sync. And then I will generate the server code first. I'm going to store it in Fabricam Fiber server code. Choose my language, VB or C Sharp, and click Next. Okay, that worked. And then go back and generate the client code. All right, we did the server, now we do the client. Put that in Fabricam Fiber client code. Choose my language. And there we go. And now what I have generated in Fabricam Fiber server code is code that goes on the server and in the client folder, code that goes in the client. Okay, so now we're done with this. We can exit. Let's go back to our project and call it Solution Explorer. And here's the code that goes on the client in my data layer, default scope entities, default scope offline content. Here's the code that goes on my service. And now, let's watch this work. So let's open up the service tickets. And notice that this one here closed is null because it's still open. So now let's run this. Okay, so I go to Terry Duffy's house and I fix the problem and I close the ticket. Okay, now I happen to be online at this point and I shut down the app. All right, and we go over to here. Let's rerun this. Did it work? Okay, Terry's gone. Come on. Uh-oh. Didn't work. Oh well. It usually works. All right. Anyway, fine. You get the point. You'll believe me that it works most of the time. Okay, so what's going on is that we have, and I don't know if you've noticed, a JavaScript application that is using SQLite to store local data. So the JavaScript application talks to the service, brings data down from the SQL server, stores it in a SQLite database, uses the data from there, both online and offline, and then syncs that data back up. And this demo works most of the time. We'll make sure before we ship it as a sample that we get all the bugs out of it. But that's the general point. Okay? All right. So that's what I wanted to talk about on data. So let's, any quick, very quick questions before we move on? Yes? How does the user know that the data is synced? Well, you could certainly alert the user. You could certainly let the user know potentially, or that's just the way the application works. So you will typically know if you're online or offline, right? But if that's an issue, you could certainly, you know, have some kind of display. You could put it in the live tile. It would probably be the best place to do it, right? So in the live tile, it tells you that you have data that's not synced. So that's probably the best way to do it. Okay, one more question, then we'll move on. Yes?
More or less, when is the sample coming out?
More or less, when is the sample coming out? Very soon. Okay, so let's talk about authentication. How do we make sure that only the right people can talk? Are those colors working? Yeah, pretty much. So we have a number of ways inside Windows 8 to do authentication. We have support for integrated Windows authentication. So there's a capability called Enterprise Authentication, and Windows, of course, knows who you are. It knows you're logged in, and so your applications can take advantage of that. We also have the ability to work with certificates. There's a root store. There's a My store. So there's a namespace for working with certificates. We're going to see a demo of both of those. We're actually going to see a demo of this third one as well. Multi-factor authentication. We have this thing called a credential picker, which is a UI that you can use to prompt the user for a username and password. We also have the ability to work with smart cards through the shared user certificates. Then we have the ability with the web authentication broker to do federated ADFS authentication, as well as single sign-on with Live and Facebook. And there's a good sample on the web authentication broker that shows you Live and Facebook. Okay. So in terms of certificates, we have the ability in the windows.security.cryptography.certificates namespace to create, install, import, and enroll certificates. Each app has its own certificate store, and then you have the ability to use certificates and private keys that are stored on smart cards by declaring the shared user certificates capability. So let's go see examples of these. All right, so we're going to have a number of scenarios here. The first scenario, and I'm going to switch over to this machine or this machine. Which one do I want to use? All right, let's use this machine. This is a Samsung Slate. It is not, actually, let's go back to here. I know, so many demos. Just can't keep track. Okay, so let's go back to the domain joined machine here. And when I call the application, this application now is talking to a WCF service that's on a server in my office, and I've configured it to not use anonymous authentication. I've configured it to use Windows authentication. So because this machine is domain joined, and I've already logged on as me, Windows just happily passes those credentials with the service over the wire to that machine, and I can just use this, and there's nothing to worry about. It just works. Okay, so now it's bring your own device to work day. And that's actually, it's bring your own device to work era, but that's not funny. Bring your own device to work day is. So now I've brought my own device to work. It's a Samsung Slate. It is not domain joined, and I want to use that application. So when I tap this application, I get a UI that says log in. And the cool thing about this UI is this UI looks like it came from Windows, because in fact it did. And it will adopt my color scheme. On this machine I've got a red scheme, so this dialog pops up in red. So I know I've heard concern with prompting for credentials, because every app prompts for credentials and the dialogues all look differently, and we're training users to just willy-nilly enter their username and password. Here, I've got a UI that looks and feels like it's Windows, so it's very trustworthy. Okay, so now, afterwards you'll explain to me why that was funny. Okay, so, how do I get this UI, you ask? Well, when the app starts, one line of code. Credential picker, which is in the windows.security.credentials.ui namespace. I call the credential picker. This is part of the runtime. And pick async will pop up this dialog. I pass the target name. I pass the prompt, enter your credentials, and the title, my expenses. So here I get my expenses, enter your credentials. So with a single line of code, this dialog shows up. Then I enter my credentials. I log in as me with my password. I could say remember my credentials, but every time I give this demo, I want this dialog to pop up. And I say OK, and now I'm in. Okay, so what did we do? We used the credential picker, And then the user entered a username, password, and domain name. And in this case, I'm storing those to application wide variables. I could store those in the credential vault. This password, by the way, is hashed. So even though it's a string, it's hashed. So it's not like you get to, in your app, read it. And then what I do is every time I make a call to the service, and because I use good practice and I create a brand new instance of the proxy client every time I make a call, then I wrote this helper method to set the credentials. And again, it's a single line of code here. Client credentials.windows.client credential set to a new network credential. I pass the username, password, and domain. And now this non-domain joined machine can talk to that service over Windows authentication with two lines of code, which is just really cool. Actually, if you want to count these lines of code, it's five lines of code. Okay? All right, so that's cool. That's a non-domain joined machine, but I am a person on the domain. Okay, well, that's kind of cool. I can type in my username and password, but there's another way that we can identify people, and that is by using a smart card. So we at Microsoft, we have our badges, very important. On the back of the badge, this little gold sticker is our smart card, and on this are private keys for various certificates. So what I want to do is have a version of this app that expects a key card or a smart card. So that's this version here. Now when I start it up, this says, oh, all right, thank you. What machine is this? 3. So now when I start this up, oh, it did it a second ago. Now it's pissed. It's mad at me for stopping it in the middle. Oh, come on. I didn't put my card in, but I went like that, and now it's being snippy. Did I lose connectivity? Nope. Okay, fine. All right, so I'm going to restart this and then talk about the code. All right, so usually I like to show the demo work first and then show you how I did it, but in this case, since this machine's acting up, I will show you how I did it. So now, when the application starts, I'm going to use the client certificate option, which is in system.net.http. And I'm going to call this HTTPS endpoint. All right, cool. This thing didn't like the things I was telling it, so now here it is. All right, so now when I start the app, I get prompted for a smart card. And the smart card reader I have in here is an Omni key. I'll hold it up so you can see it. It looks like this. And now I take this and I plug it in. Okay, smart card's ready for use. Good. And then it says enter your PIN. And over the blazingly fast internet connectivity all the way clear across campus, I'm in. How did I do that, you ask? Go ahead, ask. I will tell you. Thanks for asking. I will tell you. All right. So when the application starts, I'm going to use an HTTP client handler, and I'm going to set the client certificate options to client certification option.automatic. create a new HTTP client and then pass, talk to this server, this HTTPS endpoint, which is configured to expect a particular certificate. And then I'm going to ensure success status code. And if the call to the service fails, that will throw an exception. And in that case, I go to my error page. So again, a handful of lines of code to get this working. Now, of course, there is some things going on behind the scenes. Let's just make sure that I wrote it all down. I want to get it straight. So what do you need to do this? First thing you need is an HTTPS endpoint that's set up that's expecting a particular certificate. And I have one here, courtesy of my new friends in Windows land who created this sample and pointed me to this server and agreed to leave it up till today because they're itching to tear it down. It's not a test machine. They need to tear it down and rebuild it. And I said, please leave it up until Friday because I have the coolest demo. So thank you to them for leaving it up. So you need the HTTPS endpoint. Then you need to install their certificate in the local My Store on the device. And then you need a private key associated with that on the card. So how did I do that? So I have an example, again, which they provided me. So let's run this app. And all of the code in this is essentially, there's a sample, a Windows sample called the Certificate Manager that has all of this code. This is just a different version of that. So if you want to explore that code more, there's a sample for that. So we can create a request either locally or remotely. In this case, we're going to do it locally. Then we're going to submit this request to this endpoint. We're going to install the certificate, and this is now on my local machine. And then we can authenticate. So there are four pieces. And the code looks like this. First, we create a request, right, which is going to use the certificate enrollment manager. We're going to create a request. And then we're going to submit the request, which is a web request. There's the code there. And then finally, we're going to install the certificate. Install the certificate asynchronously. And then finally, once it's installed, we're going to authenticate, which is what I'm doing in the expense report app. When the application starts, I'm going to authenticate by calling this service, passing, I've got the certificate, which is stored locally, I've got the private key, which is on my card, and then I pass that to the HTTPS endpoint, and if it comes back without blowing up, I'm in. Okay? So that's what we need. And again, the code to do this type of stuff is not only in this app, but also in the Certificate Manager app. And then all I did was I ran the smart code version of this, which then installed the key on my card and installed the certificate on the machine. So I ran this application on this machine, and then also I had to add a certificate to the trusted root to get this machine to have the certificate so that the application could work. So a number of steps, but nothing too terribly difficult. Okay, so now we've got two different ways for our employees to use the application. But there's a third class of people that want to use the application, vendors, partners, right? Now, here at Microsoft, we have vendors and they get added to ADFS. They're V-dashes. We have partners that get B-dash accounts and they're in ADFS. But you may not do that. You might have vendors and partners that show up and they're working on projects with you and they want to file expense reports. And so you can't authenticate them with their username and with their domain credentials. You're not going to give them smart cards. So you just need to set up, username and password. Well, of course, there's a way to do that right now. So you can use the ASP.NET membership provider. But then you got to maintain the database of users and the passwords, and you have to do the UI, and you have to provide the ability for them to reset their password, and you have to take their phone calls when they forget their password. And the technical, the official response is, you know, I don't want to duplicate the wheel. In truth, I'm too lazy to write all that code. So it occurred to me when I was thinking about this that there's already a database of usernames and passwords, and it is the system formerly known as Live. It's Microsoft Accounts. So if I tell my vendors and partners, hey, get a Microsoft account, which they have because they have these cool Windows 8 machines, they already have a Microsoft account, why don't we just leverage that? So this is an Asus, what's the full name of it? The Asus VivoTab RT, which is a very nice machine. And so a vendor comes in, needs to file expense reports, fires up the app, and as long as they have connectivity, the app's going to say, enter your Microsoft account password, because the My Expenses Vendor Edition app needs to confirm your identity. Okay? So now I enter my Microsoft account password. And I'm in. Now, how did I do that? Again, handful of lines of code. There's actually two ways you can do this. You can use the Live SDK, and Live SDK has REST calls. So if you're going to be accessing their information in their Microsoft account, like their contacts and their birthday and their mail and calendar and all that, then absolutely use the Live SDK. But all I want to do is sign them in. So I don't need the Live SDK. All I need is windows.security.authentication.onlineid. And so I have this code. I'm going to use the online ID authenticator. And the first thing I do is I create a bunch of service ticket requests. And service ticket requests are nothing more than things that you want to do. So they're scopes. And the minimum one is sign in. So all I want to do is sign in. So I create an online ID service ticket request with sign in. And then I authenticate user async passing WL.signin, telling Microsoft account servers that I want to sign this person in. And then there are three choices for credential prompt type. Do not prompt, so if you've already saved the information, you wouldn't prompt. Prompt if needed, so that would be when this information's cached, so when you come in and the cache is empty, you want to prompt them. For the demo here, I used retype credentials because I want the dialog to always show up. If it fails, the ticket value will be empty, or there'll be an error code, or it'll just crash. And then I go to the error page, which says you can't access the service. So again, a handful of lines of code to call up the Microsoft account dialog that people are used to using. And so that's cool. And then I said, so I'm accessing their Microsoft account, which, and if memory serves correctly, when I fire up my machine and log in with my Microsoft account, the calendar app has access to my calendar, and the contacts app has access to my contacts, and the mail app has access to my mail. Cool. Do I get to snoop on my users? Do I get to be scurrilous and read the information out of their Microsoft account? You would hope the answer is no. But let's see. So, yeah, let's see. They won't know. I can send email on their behalf. So in the Live Connect docs, there are scopes and permissions. And look at all these. There's sign in. There's birthday, calendars, contacts, create. Cool. I can add stuff to their address book. I'm thinking I can be really evil here. So all I need to do is say, yeah, I'm just going to change this to emails. OK, cool. The users will never know. Total backdoor, right? So, yep, let's log in. And the app says, hey, this app needs permission to access your email addresses. So the gig's up. You cannot behind the scenes, without the user's permission, access any of their information. You have the APIs to do that, but the user is going to be prompted, and at this point, they're probably going to say no, and you know, you're going to change your mind and not do that anymore. Okay, so the basic, all we need here is sign in. That's the absolute basic, and then all I'm doing is letting them send their username and password and authenticating them. So that is three examples of how we can authenticate. There are, of course, other options, but I think those are three good ones. So now we've authenticated, what about protecting data? Well, in the Windows.security.cryptography.data protection class, we have the data protection provider, the data protection namespace. We have the data protection provider class, which has protect and unprotect, which have been in the .NET framework for a while, so you may be used to those. If you just want a simple way to encrypt and decrypt data, you can use that. If you want something more robust, then we have Windows.security.cryptography.core. It gives you the ability to encrypt, sign, hash. We have symmetric keys. We have asymmetric keys. We have a number of algorithm providers. There are a lot of ways that you can sign and hash and encrypt data. And if you're interested in that, I would highly recommend you go to the crypto. There's a crypto sample, a cryptography sample in the Windows samples, and it shows all of these and all of the various options, whether it's, you know, 128 or 256 or 512 or on and on and on and on, a whole bunch of things. Okay, so that's authentication. Any quick questions before we move on? Okay, any rousing cheers for the coolness of my demos? Thank you. Okay, what about testing? Obviously, we're going to sit here in Visual Studio, we're going to test and whatnot. One thing that we can do, we don't have coded UI testing at the moment. Hopefully, that's coming soon. But we do have the ability to do manual testing with Test Manager. Right, if you have Visual Studio 2012 Pro or above, and you have Team Foundation Server, which is supposed to be in all caps but was changed, you can validate the app based on a test suite. You can do exploratory testing. Test Manager is very cool because you connect to the Windows 8 device, and it's recording what you're doing, including your tapping, and you can attach screenshots. This works both on x86 and ARM devices. And I wanted to do a demo of this. But it occurred to me that A, I don't have a lot of time, and B, I was just going to do the exact same demo that Brian Keller did on Channel 9. So if you want to see how this works, go watch Brian do it. And he does a very good job in this video and shows how you can test Windows Store apps using Test Manager. Okay. Now, perfect. Okay. So in terms of testing, actually, let me pop back for a second. In terms of testing, obviously, you're going to test on your computer, and you should also take advantage of the simulator. All right? The cool thing about the simulator is that it ships with Visual Studio, and it is basically a virtual machine. It shows you your machine. Right, there I am, Robert Green. And you can see what your apps are going to look like in portrait as well as landscape mode. You can also test on various resolutions. So what would it look like on a 27-inch monitor? You can take screenshots. So this does a pretty good job of simulating various devices. But of course, there's nothing like testing on the device you're actually going to run it on. What's the app look like on this machine? What's the app actually look like on this machine? So to do that, we can do remote testing. All you got to do is go get the remote tools for Visual Studio 2012 from MSDN. There's versions for x86, x64, and ARM. Install that on the device. Then debug the connect from your development machine to the device, debug the app from Visual Studio, the device will prompt you for a developer license. You enter that. It's the same developer license that you have on your other machines. Expires the same day in all likelihood. And then what Visual Studio does is it packages the app and deploys it to this machine. So let's see that work. So let's... What app do we want to do? I want to choose the Windows... I want to choose the Expenses with Live Connect app. So I'm here. And then what I want to do, pop over to this machine, press the right button first, pop over to this machine, and start the remote debugger, okay? Which says, MSVS Mon started a new server named PayPal 24016, and it occurs to me that this isn't going to work because you need to be an admin on the machine. So I need to log in as Googs, which presumably is okay with him. He's the new head of DPE. I'm sure he doesn't mind me impersonating him. Okay, so now I'm logged in as an administrator. Start up the remote debugger. And MSVS Mon started a new server named PayPal 2, which is the name of this machine, waiting for new connection. So now I go over to Visual Studio. And is this going to work? Probably not. So what I do is come in here, go to Properties, set the target device to remote machine, and see if it finds it on my subnet, which it probably isn't, because this machine is hooked up on the show wireless. This machine's on the corporate network. So let's pop over to this machine, which is on the corporate network. It's a non-domain joined machine, which is fine, but it's still on the corpnet. Do I have remote debugging on this? Please say I do. Yes, remote debugger. Okay, so now RO Green Samsung. So now I pop back here. Aha! Visual Studio has found this machine, RO Green Samsung. Cool. So I'm going to work on that. Let's use that one. Let's select this machine. I can use authentication or not. So now what I'm going to do is run this. And I'm asked to log on to this machine. So I will log on as me, our green Samsung, Robert. Fine. Remember my credentials. Pop over. And then, yes, so if we look over here, it says Robert is connected. Pop over here. Visual Studio says there's already a version of this on the machine. Do you want to overwrite it? I say yes. And then if we pop over here, the app has started. So I'm now remote debugging on this machine. I can set breakpoints. I can step through, and I can see exactly how this app works. And I've also, by the way, now deployed this app on this machine. So I can, it's on the start screen, so I can run it. So that works, again, for x86, x64, and ARM machines. So that is a great way to test the app on the device it's actually going to run on. OK, so the last thing we want to talk about in the 1 minute we have left is deployment. But I have nothing in slides beyond what Kushal had said. So I just want to briefly review sideloading. Or, as we call it, IT direct distribution. App needs to be signed with a trusted certificate. That certificate needs to be trusted on all of the machines. It's the exact same certificates you're using today. There's no brand new set of certificates that you're using in Windows 8. We recommend that you run the WAC, the Windows App Certification Kit. We recommend that you check that the app is using only the required capabilities. That's critically important if you're putting the app in the store. It's a recommendation and a heavy recommendation if you're going to sideload. Then for sideloading, there's a group policy for install all trusted apps that you have to turn on. You have to make sure the signing certificates are trusted. And then you need to enable the machine for sideloading. Windows 8 Enterprise domain joined is automatically able to be sideloaded. Windows a professional WinRT non-domain joined machines, then you get a secondary product key through your volume licensing, and then you are good to go. And at that point, you can sideload. Now, there are two ways of sideloading. You can sideload using PowerShell. You can sideload using You can sideload using self-service portals. So, what do I have? Did I lose all my apps on this? Oh, it's because I'm logged in as Googs. So let's go back. Let's log in as me. And so let's uninstall this app, and let's go reinstall it. Then remember, this is a Windows RT machine, so I can certainly do this. Create the package in Visual Studio, come in here, and with my finger, hold down long enough for the right click menu to show up, run with PowerShell. Found the package, it's installing the package, it will sometimes prompt you for a certificate. Do you trust the certificate? Because I've done this before, it just installs it, and now that app is installed. And if you do it immediately, Windows caches where the app was in your start screen, so it puts it back where it got it from. Eventually that cache will empty out, but if you uninstall and reinstall, it goes right back where it was. So running PowerShell works perfectly fine. Now, if you don't want to do PowerShell, you have other options. If you have System Center Configuration Manager, you can set up an application catalog. Oops. Where'd you go? There you are. Okay, so notice this is using System Center Configuration Manager, and it has all kinds of apps, including the usual desktop apps, and it also has Windows 8 apps. So this is nothing new. This has been in System Center all along. So you can certainly do this using the older API and the older experience. You can also build your own self-service portal. Kushal showed you an example. I was going to show you another example, but they've got it down for the week, so it's not going to actually get us very far. But there's the Corporate App Center, which we use internally, which is an internal, it's an app that displays various Windows 8 apps you can install. So it looks kind of similar to what Kushal showed in the previous talk. And this is where you can load up your Windows 8 apps for your user to get to, like the My Expenses app and then other ones. Okay, so that's pretty much what I wanted to talk about on deployment. He talked about it, so I talked about it a little bit. So there we go. So what we did, we're only 5 minutes long, is we looked at some of the things that you'll be wondering about building Windows Store business apps. You know, we've learned about the why. So now we talked at what data do I talk to? How do I talk to the data? We looked at a number of options, certainly not all of them, but a number of ways you can authenticate. We talked about the testing, particularly testing on the device, the remote debugging, and then we touched briefly on deployment. And so thank you very much. Hope you had a great time, and I'll now open it up to even more questions. Yes?
So every time we talk about running a business app development on the day, you get this far, and then you barely scratch the surface, and you get to the
So is the quest? So is the question about certificates or about the self-service portal?
Right,
So this is for the secondary product keys, specifically? Oh, so when I say you need a trusted certificate, you can create a certificate yourself. You can use MakeCert, create a certificate, and then decide that that certificate is trusted on machines, right? You take that certificate, and as an administrator, you double-click on it, and you install it into the trusted root, and now the computer trusts that certificate. So it could be a certificate that you created yourself, could be a certificate that your company created, one that follows the chain of your company's certificate. It could be something you went out and got from VeriSign. You can absolutely create them yourself. Not familiar enough with how Windows Phone uses certificates to compare it, but I do know that for Windows 8, I mean, when I did that certificate demo, the guy sent me he said, "Oh, you'll need this certificate." And I got that certificate from him, and I installed it. I've also created a certificate myself, called it rogreen.cer, right? It's trusted by me. I happen to be the only user, so that's okay. And I go on a machine where I'm the administrator, and I trust the certificate that I created myself 20 minutes ago. So
I was under the impression you had to sign the self-service portal to push that
to the store. So if you submit an app to the store, it's going to be signed by the store with a certificate that all Windows 8 machines trust because it's coming from Microsoft. But for internal, you as the admin decide what certificates are trusted. Many corporations, enterprises have a way of creating certificates. They have a corporate certificate, and then if you're going to create additional certificates off of that, they need to follow some kind of chain, and then there's a group policy, an administrative policy over what certificates can be installed. You'd probably push it out using the management tools, so you'd go through IT. Many organizations have that structure. You, if you're the IT, you define your structure. If the administrator installs the certificate and says to the computer, "By the way, you trust this certificate, and I'm an administrator, and I said so," that's all it takes. Now, in an enterprise, that's not good enough, but technically, that's the way it works. Yes?
So are there any APIs to install apps from, say, a modern app, Windows 8 app?
Are there any APIs to install apps? No. You can use the management tools, Intune or System Center Configuration Manager, to push apps out. You can use scripts that are pushed out to run the PowerShell, but you cannot from an app install another app. That would violate the... Sorry?
There's a windows.management.deployment namespace, but it says specifically for desktop apps. Does that mean a line of business app that's mock installed but not Windows Store run that?
That's a good question. Can a Windows Store app run the API to install desktop apps? If it's in the Windows runtime, presumably. I haven't tried that. It's possible, but yeah, I'm not 100% sure. But clearly, one Windows Store app cannot install another Windows Store app. That would violate the principle of the sandbox and apps running in isolation. So the question is, can you literally push apps out and force install on a device? If it's a domain join machine that is being managed by Intune or Configuration Manager, absolutely. Which is the same way it works today. I get updates pushed to my domain join machine, quite often. So you could absolutely do that with Windows Store apps. You could push out the install, you could push out updates. For a WinRT, all you can do is make the app available either by PowerShell or in the self-service portal and alert the user. You could write into the app that it calls an internal service to check what the latest version of the app is and have it not run if the user's not on the current version, but there's no way of forcing it. WinRT has a pull model, not a push and as well as a pull model. The domain join machines have both. Yes?
So when
So can you create a WinRT, a Windows Store app on WinRT that will execute PowerShell scripts? I think the answer is yes. I think the answer is yes. I have to double check on that. Yes. Trap in terms of storing it?
Yeah, storing
it. Okay, so the question is, on authentication, can you store the username and password? Yes, there is something called the password vault or the certificate vault. I think it's the password vault, which is a local store that you can talk to programmatically. So you could take that user ID and domain and put it in the vault and leave it there, which is, of course, what you do, you know, in these real live apps. You wouldn't necessarily, for demo purposes, I popped that up immediately, but you know, you wouldn't want it to necessarily run every time. You'd have the user enter their credentials, you'd store them, and then in the settings, you'd have a way for them to, you know, change that information when their password changes. So if you want to store information related to the app itself. So there's a couple things you can do. You can store application specific information locally using the application data APIs. And if you wanted to store it remotely, you could always call a service and pass that data as long as it's information that you're happy to send over the wire. Right, did that answer the question?
I ran into a problem with SkyDrive. You go out to the SkyDrive, people log in to SkyDrive. There's no way to get back login ID.
Let's take this offline because it's really a question for the SkyDrive guys. So if you want, we'll take it offline and we can go ask them. Yes, I know I've been avoiding this side of the room, so sorry. Yes?
What about when you're not connected in terms of authentication?
When you're not connected in terms of authentication. So I guess what you would do is when the user's online, you'd authenticate them, and then you'd store those credentials in the password vault, and then you would go get them from the password vault.
And authenticate that way?
Yeah, which is local on the machine.
Yes.
And of course, sorry, and that's good until, right, that's good until you're, yeah, that would be good when they're back online. Yeah, sorry. So, yes, I'm overcomplicating it. Yes?
We have two separate apps, one for Windows and integrated security and one for live. Is that because you have to do two separate apps, or is there, you could put them together and
So, right. So the question is, I had separate apps for Windows authentication, for smart card, for live. Do they have to be separate apps or can I combine them? I could have absolutely combined those. And what I could have done is I can check to see if the users are domain user. If they are, there's nothing I need to do. Or I could prompt them for their smart card. If they're not a domain user, there's a call userinformation.getDomainNameAsync or getDomain, I think it's getDomainNameAsync, and it returns nothing if you're not in a domain. So I can tell by calling that whether you're in a domain. Then I could prompt you for your smart card. Otherwise, I could prompt you for your username and password, and I could, other ways that maybe programmatically I could determine whether I prompt you for username and password, an internal one or an external one through your Microsoft account. So yeah, I could absolutely have used all of those in the same app. Yes?
So you said the credential picker gives you a password hashed. So if we wanted to build our own UI for collecting usernames and passwords, can we set the unhashed passwords on the network credential thing, or do we have to hash it ourselves?
You don't have to hash it. The credential picker has a number of options. You can return the information in clear text if you want. There's like half a dozen different options for how you hash it and what you hash it with.
So when you set it on the, you set it on the, like the network credential class that you made, and you can that accept it, whether it's hashed or unhashed, or like, does it make a difference?
So this was the Windows authentication example?
Yeah.
So does it behave differently based on how you hash it? I doubt it. Because, I mean, the hash is, when I set up Windows authentication in IIS, and I then pass it a password, it knows whether it's clear text or hashed, and IIS has the capability, Windows on that machine has the capability of dealing with whatever I send it. It knows how to unhash it or how to unencrypt it. So you should be able to send it any way you want. Yes.
When I need to install an app on the device, does the device have to be "quote unquote" provisioned first with a certificate that ties my device ID to the app, so the app knows it can run on that specific device?
Does the Does the app need to be configured so that it? Does the device need to be configured so apps know it can run on that device?
Correct.
I've not heard of anything like that in Windows 8.
Okay.
So I don't think so.
So potentially you can install a debugment profile app on the machine that will keep running there forever, right? Yeah. The way Apple does it is so that it expires after a certain time.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So if you... You can take a Windows RT device and you can go get a developer license, right? Because all you need to get for a developer license is your Microsoft account. That then gives you the ability to install apps on that machine for testing purposes. Your developer license expires regularly, and the app will not run if the license has then expired. Just as an app will not run if it's signed with a certificate and the certificate expires, it won't run. So, this is not a backdoor for massive distribution in production, but, we left that, we have that in there so that you can test. Yes?
Follow up question to my earlier question, using PowerShell within RTF.
Uh-huh.
So how do I actually do that?
How do you do that? I have no idea. I honestly don't know. I think you can do it because I've heard... I think I've had this conversation before. I think you can, but don't believe me. Go test it. So, and I don't... What? Send me an email about this. Let's find out if you literally can, and I'll go talk to the guy who I think said... I'll find out if you actually can do it. So let's assume you can't. And then send me an email and we'll find out if you can, because I actually don't know. Yes?
So for Windows RT machines, you need to have a secondary product key to install the allow business application, right?
Yes, for Windows RT machines to sideload, you need a secondary product key.
Okay. Is it prohibited to add domain join by any chance to Windows RT?
Windows RT machines cannot be domain joined.
It's no plan.
Right. Now, another thing you could do is you can run a VPN, right? You can VPN a remote connect into a machine that is domain joined. So that's another option we should mention.
But it doesn't allow me to install that application into my Windows RT machine.
Right. That would not allow you to install the app to your Windows RT machine, but it would allow you to run the app when you're connected.
Like remote desktop, is
it? Yep, remote desktop or do a VPN in. Right. Okay, one question in the very back. Yes. It is literally, yes, it is literally true that you cannot write a Windows Store app and then just go to your wife's machine and just install it. So in that case, what you would do is put it in the store. you can always put the app in the store. If you already have a store account, then, there's no additional cost. If you don't, then there's a small cost to get a store account, so you could do that. You could put apps in the store and tell your wife, go get it from the store, or tell your mother or whatever, go get it from the store. We're always interested in your feedback on the subject. You can, I'm not sure what role the certificates play in it, but under your developer license, you can create an app in Visual Studio. So I guess the Visual Studio certificate is trusted.
Yeah, and I thought it was like an example. So we have ClipOnce applications, and you sign those with a certificate, and then machines that trust that cert can run it.
Mm-hmm. Could very well be. Again, if you want a better answer to that, shoot me an email with the scenario and I'll go get the real answer.
So,
yes?
So these are two kind of separate questions. One, where do we get sideloading keys?
Where do you get sideloading keys? Through volume licensing. So if you have a volume licensing agreement with Microsoft, you go to volume licensing. There's a website there, and you can acquire them that way. So you need a service agreement, a volume licensing agreement with Microsoft for that.
Okay. And the second question was, can you build our own self-service portal?
Can you build your own self-service portal? Yes, you can. I'm not 100% sure what if you get one with the System Center, that would be a question for them, but yes, you can certainly build your own.
Okay. So follow-up question to what he asked, is there a white paper or anything available so that helps you create your self-service portal and communicate with?
Is there any information on how to create a self-service portal available? I haven't seen anything at the moment. But again, if you want a little bit more information than that, shoot me an email and I'll ask the guys on that team.
That would be second email. I already gave one to you. So.
Fine. You can email me weekly. I'm always happy to talk about this stuff. Or you can send me one email with multiple questions. Actually, probably be easier to send me multiple emails.
Yeah.
That way I can just forward it.
I already shot one at you, so
cool.
Send me one more.
All right. Yes. For QA, if it's for testing purposes, just use your developer license.
Okay. And kind of like a different question, is there a way to limit an app to be loaded based on a set of UIDs and other devices will not be able to run this app?
So you want to limit the app to certain devices based on some unique identifier on that device? And so you need to have a list of, so you're not going to do it with username and with some kind of username and password. You want to literally do it based on the ID of that device.
Exactly, right. So that would be either for testing or for
right.
quote unquote security, like tying device with an app.
Yeah. I know there have been discussions about this on some internal alias, but I don't remember the answer on how you get a unique identifier. So send me an email on that.
Thank you.
Yes. Yes, you can remote debug from an x86 machine to a WinRT machine, yes. That will deploy it on that machine using your developer license, yes, for testing purposes, correct? Can stay on the machine, and it's good as long as your developer license is good. Yep. For testing purposes, of course. I don't want you to violate your license or anything. All right. Thank you guys. Oh, one more, and then we're done. You again.
Yeah. I have a lot of questions. So if we extend that concept a little bit, just not just managing the apps, like device management sort of idea for self-service portal, can that be done? Or is there any more information available on that?
So you want to write your own ways of managing devices? Sure. I mean, there are third parties that can do that, so you could do it too. So how do you do it? How do the third parties do it?
Whatever.
Yeah. Sure. It's Windows. Remember, it's just Windows. It's Windows 8, but it's still Windows.
Or WinRT platform.
Yeah. Well, WinRT. That I have no idea. I have no idea how you would do that. Yeah, I have no idea. That I don't know. All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.